Okay, well, I don't know if you're like our family, but we read the Christmas story on Christmas morning from the Bible. I don't know if any of you read the Christmas story this week, but if you did, hopefully you made some connections to what we've been looking at from the intertestamental period. We have Jesus being born under Caesar Augustus, and the Syrian ruler Quirinius is mentioned, who we talked a little bit about. And then we have the flight to Egypt because of Herod the Great and his maniacal persecution of the one that was born king of the Jews. We have the flight to Egypt, which we, you know, have that connection that we've looked at in the intertestamental period. And then we've also got the return then back in when Joseph learned that Herod Archelaus was ruling, who was also a tyrant like his father. He went to Nazareth and didn't come back to the area of Bethlehem. When we were reading the story, I noticed all those connections to what we've been looking at over the class. So where we left off last time, we're on handout 16. We had pretty much finished the Sanhedrin. So just to put everything in context, we're looking at the religious situation at the opening of the New Testament. So we've been through the political situation, the cultural situation, and now we're finishing off looking at the religious situation. And so we took a look at the high priesthood. And last class, we took a look at the Sanhedrin. And you do remember that there was a close connection between the Sadducees and the high priesthood. The Sadducees were dominating the high priesthood at this point in history. And then when we looked at the Sanhedrin, we noted that the Sanhedrin, which is the ruling council, was made up of a mixed body of Sadducees and Pharisees. And even though it was the wealthy Sadducean families controlled the high priesthood and dominated the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, although they were a minority, exerted a lot of influence because they were well-liked by the people. They were popular with the people, which was not the case with the Sadducees. And then we were looking at some examples of how the Sanhedrin was convened. We read Acts chapter 4, verses 1 through 6 to look at that. And the high priest would be the one that was presiding over the Sanhedrin. And so that would have been a Sadducean high priest at this point in history. We see the example of the high priest presiding over the trial of Jesus. You remember that Jesus was brought before the high priest, first Annas, who was sort of the father figure for the high priesthood, and then Caiaphas, his son-in-law, who was the high priest during the time of Jesus' trial. But they were brought before them. And then you remember that Jesus was eventually pronounced guilty by them. And then after that proceeding, they took him to the Roman government to try to exact punishment on Jesus. We also find that the high priest presided over the council during Stephen's trial. He was the spokesman at Stephen's trial in Acts chapter 6. When Paul was brought on trial at the end of Acts, in Acts chapter 22 and 23, he also refers to the high priest and all the council. So we see that close connection with the high priest presiding over the council. So just to finish off the Sanhedrin, although it was reduced to a religious court at this point, we talked about that, how after the Romans took over and during the rules of the Herods as well as the Roman government, the Sanhedrin would have been reduced really just to a religious court. But it did retain a significant amount of local authority in Jerusalem, as we see in the trials of Jesus and in the trial of Paul. They still had a lot of influence, even though they were sort of like a puppet court, if you will, under the ultimate authority of Rome. So that's kind of where we left off last time, finished off with the Sanhedrin. And what we're going to turn to now is looking at the Jewish sects. So we'll start off by looking at the origins of the sects. Now, all of this, again, this is another example of something that we find references to all of these people, and they're not found at all in the Old Testament. All of these sects arose during the intertestamental period. And so practically all of our information on the sects, on the origins of the sects and where they came from, is found either in the New Testament or in Josephus. And so we'll be taking a pretty good look at some of the things that Josephus says here about the origins of the sects. So he first refers to them, the sects, and by the sects, what I'm talking about here are the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Those are the ones that are mentioned by Josephus. This is the first reference we have in literature to the sects, is in Josephus. And he says that they were in existence at the time of Jonathan. And that Jonathan is the Maccabean Jonathan, the brother of Judas Maccabee. If you remember way back when we looked at the Maccabean Revolt, we had the three brothers who led in succession before the setup of what is called the Hasmonean dynasty. And so Jonathan was one of those brothers, and in his time is the first reference that we have to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Yeah, the date of Jonathan was 152 to 143 BC. So that's the first reference that we have in history and literature to the sects. Now, you remember when we looked at the Hasmonean dynasty, there was a big conflict that arose in the period of John Hyrcanus and subsequent rulers between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So we know that's the first time that we see like this major conflict between the two parties, which is not long after the time of Jonathan. So Jonathan was 152 to 143 BC, and then John Hyrcanus, who was a successor in the Hasmonean line, was 134 to 104 BC. So we know that that conflict began with John Hyrcanus. And so what that tells us is that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the parties of Judaism, were well established by that time because they were unique individuals who had political alliances. And we see that conflict there that we looked at earlier. So we know that by the time of John Hyrcanus, the parties were well established. Now, why did these parties arise? What were some of the factors in making these distinct groups within Judaism? I've identified a few factors here. One of them was the rise of the synagogue. In a previous class, we studied the synagogue and what that was. But if you remember, the synagogue brought sort of a shift in focus in Judaism. It brought a rise in the teaching and study of the law. Remember, the ceremonial aspects of temple worship could not be performed in the synagogue. So the synagogue was not centered so much around a religious worship service, but it was really focused on expounding the scriptures, reading the scriptures, and then teaching. And we have the rise of the rabbis and things like that who would be teachers of the law that arose in the synagogue. And this change in emphasis then led to the rise of scholars. So we have rabbis and scribes on the scene now, who devoted their lives to the studying and copying of the scriptures. And so there's a shift there from the priesthood more to the study of the law in the synagogue. And that was a factor in some of the differences in these parties. You remember now the Pharisees, well, we haven't really talked about them yet, we're going to get to them, but the Pharisees were more in with the common people, more associated with the teachers of the law, where the Sadducees were more associated with the high priesthood. So we start to see these factors distinguishing the parties from one another. The other thing that we looked a lot at was Hellenization and the response to Hellenization, whether people accepted it or rejected it. And that was another factor in the rise of these parties. We have different responses to Hellenization, and these people sort of tended to group by their responses to that, you know, whether they were rejectors or acceptors of it. That's another factor here in the differentiation of the parties. And then we had the different reactions to the Hasmonean dynasty. So you remember when we talked about the Hasmoneans, eventually what those leaders did was they assumed the high priesthood for themselves, and that led to mixed reactions. Some people were not happy about that. More of the Orthodox Jews were not happy about that. And so that also contributed to these different schools, the different reactions to the Hasmonean dynasty's assumption of the priesthood. And then we just have the ongoing challenge. This is, you might put this more under the category of politics, the ongoing challenge of how to relate to the foreign governing powers that were in existence during the intertestamental period and then into the rule of Rome. You had different reactions, different ideas about how we should relate to our overlords, the people who are in charge. So all of these things were factors in the rising of these different parties. And so it was during this period, after the Maccabean Revolt, that we begin to see these distinct groups within Judaism. And then, as we know from our New Testaments, these groups were often rival groups. They were at odds with one another. We'll take a look at some of the reasons for that in a few minutes. The disagreements between the groups were often an entanglement of religious and political concerns. It wasn't necessarily one or the other, but we see both of those factors in play here in the disagreements between the parties. One other thing to note, D.S. Russell made this point. He said that although the parties are called sects by Josephus, The term sect is not the same as our modern equivalent to describe unorthodox Christians. You know, that's why we also sometimes have them called parties rather than sects. But you often hear about the Jewish sects, and it's just important to recognize that sect there is not the same way that we would describe like a cult or something of Christianity. The Jews all basically held to the same view of God, the same authority of the Torah. They did differ in how to interpret Scripture, particularly as it affected their practice. One of the points that we'll make later is, well, it's actually right here. Judaism was very interested in practice, how you live your life. And so I have a quote here from D.S. Russell that says, this is what he says, "Judaism was in fact much less concerned about right belief than about accepted practice." So that's an important thing to keep in mind. When we go through the different beliefs of the parties, we look at it and we see these, well, I look at it and I see pretty big differences in the beliefs that seem very fundamental. But you have to remember that the doctrine wasn't everything that they were concerned about. They were very concerned about how you're living and how you're practicing the Jewish religion. And so a lot of the differences in interpretation of Scripture are related to how it's going to affect our practice. And so that's just something to keep in mind. It's a little bit of a different mindset than we might have today about doctrine in life. And so the details of where these groups came from are unknown. The groups just simply appear in the literature. They appear on the scene in the historical writings. There's no explanation of where they came from, in other words, in Josephus. He just refers to them as being in existence. But since we know the general time frame about when they arose, we can also offer pretty educated guesses on the origins and where they came from. And so we'll talk about that when we look at each of the parties in turn. So that's kind of the introduction. Any questions? Yes, Daniel. The question is, was the interest in practice related to the Mosaic Covenant that says, for instance, do this and you will live? I don't know how to answer that. Probably that's a factor. You could say it's related to that concept or misunderstanding of the Mosaic Covenant as a works righteousness. In the group of the Pharisees, that expands into the oral tradition and all these additional rules that are made. It's like you're thinking, I think, it's all just rules that we have to live by, and that's how we get our worth before God. Well, when I said that we don't really know the details of the origins, all I'm saying is that this isn't unique to these sects. This is all ancient history. You have this, you know, something appears on the scenes in the writings. We have this in the early church fathers often too, even with doctrines. It's stated in a writing, and then we have to figure out where that came from. So Josephus, for instance, refers to these sects, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes, and saying they were in existence in the time of Jonathan. And then he gives us examples of the conflict later under John Hyrcanus specifically. He gives us all the details of the infighting and stuff. But he doesn't say, this is where they came from. He doesn't ever explain that. The secondary sources will just say, they just appear on the scene in the historical record. So that's all I'm saying with that. Does that answer that question? You're right with the works and the heart issue as well. It's easy to make a list of rules that you can set up for yourself to keep. But the real question is where your heart is. And that, of course, is exactly where Jesus goes when he confronts the sects, these people in the New Testament. All right, any other questions or comments? All right, well, let's take a look at what we know about the sects. We'll start with the Pharisees. So in order to understand the origin of the Pharisees, we kind of need to go back and review the response to the Hellenization that we saw in the intertestamental period. So you remember we had this group that came on the scene by the name of the Hasidim. It's the Hasidians, or the Hasidim is referred to as, they're the pious ones who resisted Hellenization and defended Jewish tradition during the Maccabean era. The Hasidim are first mentioned by name at the time of the Maccabean revolt, and we find that in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. If you remember now, many of them had sympathy with the armed resistance of the Maccabeans. So Judas was the first leader there, and we had the armed Maccabean revolt And many of the Hasidim were in alliance with the Maccabeans and gave their support to or joined the resistance movement. However, it is likely that as the later Hasmoneans began assuming more and more authority and taking on the high priesthood, most scholars believe that the Hasidim probably became more and more opposed to the movement at that point because they weren't happy about the Maccabeans or the Hasmoneans assuming the priesthood. And then we see the further secularization of the rulers during that period. So the Hasidim, these pious ones, we would describe them as religious conservatives who were putting their weight behind the initial Maccabean revolt. They are commonly believed to be the predecessors of the Pharisees and the Essenes, at least spiritually. And you find that a lot of the secondary sources just come right out and say that. Here's a quote here. The Hasidim were supplanted by the Pharisees and the Essenes. So you'll find a lot of statements like that. So the Pharisees, along with the more strict Essenes, were unhappy with the secularization of the priesthood, very similar to the way the Hasidim would have been reacting. Then if you remember, and I referred to this earlier today, there was this important historical event where we had the conflict with the Hasmonean rulers. And so it might be good to just review briefly that conflict. So the Pharisees had a lot of power in the early days of the Hasmoneans. One of the Hasmonean rulers was John Hyrcanus, and there was a breach between John Hyrcanus and the Pharisees because one of them denounced him for holding the high priesthood. So exactly the issue we were just speaking about. Well, that made him very angry, and he basically threw the Pharisees out and switched his allegiance to the party of the Sadducees. And he actually forbade the regulations of the Pharisees. So there was a big reversal in fortune, if you will, here between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that breach grew under the rule of Janaeus Alexander, who was a subsequent ruler. He strongly favored the Sadducees. During his time, there was actually an open revolt by the party of the Pharisees and their supporters. And I don't know if you remember the story, but he actually slaughtered many of the Pharisees and their supporters during his rule. And this became sort of a notorious event in the history of Judaism that is referred to later as the time when Alexander slaughtered the Pharisees or put the rabbis to death. Well, this, of course, furthered the breach between the Pharisees and the Sadducees as well as the rulers. But then this breach was reversed because you remember that Janaeus Alexander on his deathbed counseled his wife to make peace with the Pharisees. Probably for political expediency because he realized that the Pharisees were more popular with the common people and she was probably in danger of another revolt. So she actually followed his advice after he died and made peace with the Pharisees and restored them to power within the Sanhedrin, the council. Remember, this conflict is looming in the background in the conflicts that we read about in the New Testament. This is all history that had led up to that point. When we read about the Pharisees in the New Testament, then we have to keep that historical battle in mind. What does Pharisee mean? Well, the origin of the name Pharisee is unclear. Probably the most common interpretation of it that I found is that it originates from a Hebrew word, peresh, which means to separate. There's a lot of questions about what are they separating from, and I think the common consensus is that probably it refers to the fact that they're separating from that which is unclean. So sort of being set apart, almost like, you know, being set apart as holy, that kind of a separation. So we're not exactly sure, but Pharisee may derive from that term. Okay, so that's sort of what we know about the origins of the Pharisees. The next thing we'll look at is their belief system. We'll just highlight a few of their major beliefs. One of the beliefs that distinguishes the Pharisees is that they believed also in an oral law, not only the written law, but they believed in an oral law. So they believed that the oral law or tradition was also handed down from Moses, and it has the same authority, therefore, as the written law. So this is the elaborate system then that was built up. There was an elaborate system of oral laws that really were given to give guidance in every area of life. And that law then, that oral tradition, became just as authoritative as the law itself. This probably developed over a long period of time where it actually had the same authority as the written law. Josephus mentions these in his Antiquities. He says that these are observances which are not written in the laws of Moses. Now remember, Josephus was a Pharisee too. When we read some of his critical comments on the Sadducees, we'll have to remember that his own autobiography says that he had looked and studied all of the sects and decided that the Pharisees were the way he wanted to go. So just keep that in mind when we look at his comments. But this oral tradition, this is also what is called the fence around the law. And you remember what that is. The idea is that there's a law here that provides a line that I shouldn't cross. But I don't want to accidentally cross the line. So I'm going to build another fence that's further back from the law to stop me at that point so I don't ever get close enough to go over the law, go over the line, to transgress the law. And so one good example of that is the time of the Sabbath observance. They would sometimes back off and make sure that the Sabbath was starting a little bit earlier so we make sure that we don't accidentally lose track of time or something and then go over and end up breaking the Sabbath. So that's what we mean by the fence around the law. And you'll often hear that stated. Yeah, Bill. Well, the Sabbath day's journey, if you remember, and the way it was used, it was from the Mount of Olives to Jerusalem. So that's just, I don't know how long that is, a mile maybe. So it's probably referring to a journey that you could easily make on foot in an afternoon or something like that. So this oral law that we're talking about is referred to in the New Testament as the tradition of the elders. So let me read a passage here from Mark. We're going to be looking at a lot of examples from the Bible here. In Mark chapter 7, we have this tradition of the elders referred to, and this is Mark chapter 7, verses 5 through 8. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands?" And he replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites, as is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men.'" So when we hear those words, the traditions of men, the tradition of the elders, what's being referred to is this oral tradition of the Pharisees that is in addition to the written law. What I'm planning to do here is to go through the descriptive elements of the sects. And then at the end, we're going to look at Jesus' interaction with the sects, because he actually had interactions with both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so what I've done is I've gathered all of those interactions at the end of this so we can kind of group them in categories of what he was criticizing. So we won't be talking at this point about his critique here. We'll talk about his critique when we get to the end of the section. So this is the oral law, the tradition of the elders, and Russell says that it was probably, this is a quote now, it was probably this claim of the Pharisees, that is this body of oral tradition, which caused the final breach between the two parties in the Sanhedrin during the reign of John Hyrcanus. And actually Josephus talks about that a little bit. He hints at that in his discussion of that conflict. But this was a major issue between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which we'll talk about when we get to the Sadducees in a moment, but just so you keep that in mind. The Pharisees were supernaturalists. That is, they believed in a spiritual world of angels and demons. We see that again in Paul's trial in Acts chapter 23, verses 8 and 9. This is when he threw out his statement that says, "I'm a Pharisee and I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." We get this note starting in verse 8. "The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, stood up and argued vigorously. 'We find nothing wrong with this man,' they said. 'What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?'" So you see there that what's being articulated is the belief that there are angels and there are spirits. There is a supernatural realm beyond the natural world. So that was a belief of the Pharisees. And then kind of going along with that is related doctrines, the immortality of the soul, a future judgment, and along with a future judgment, rewards and punishments, and the resurrection of the virtuous. So we saw right there a reference to the resurrection. it's not 100% clear what their doctrine of the resurrection was. I don't think it was identical to ours today as Christians, but they did believe that there is a resurrection of the virtuous. Good souls are going to go into resurrected bodies, while bad souls will go to eternal punishment. So they did believe in a resurrection of the dead. And then finally, the final belief that I wanted to highlight is a belief in, quote, fate. That's what Josephus calls it. And probably what he means by fate is not the way we would talk about fate today, but he probably had in view a doctrine of providence, so that they believe in providence. And I think the reason we know that is because of some of the statements that he makes, and actually a statement that we have from the New Testament. So he says, this isn't from his book, The Wars of the Jews, he says that the Pharisees ascribe all to fate and to God. So you can see there fate and God going together. So it's not fate like Greek fate. It's more a doctrine of providence, I think, an understanding of providence. What Josephus tells us about this view is that the Pharisees believed that man has the freedom to act, but God, at the same time, what God wills will be accomplished. And he says, again in his book of the Wars, fate does cooperate in every action. So it's interesting. It almost seems like our Reformed doctrine of concurrence of the will, which is just a way of saying that there's human freedom working in parallel with God's providential control of all things. So human beings are free to act according to their desires, but God is overseeing everything in such a way that everything is going to work together for his purposes, down to the smallest detail of our actions and thoughts. That's, of course, a mystery that we can't quite explain how that all works, but we believe both in human responsibility and God's providence. And so it was interesting to me that this sounds a little bit like that, like the Pharisees had a doctrine of freedom, but yet God is still in control providentially of everything that's happening. And the statement that we have from Gamaliel in Acts chapter 5, actually, now that you know that, you see if you read this and hear it a little bit differently. You remember this is when the apostles were brought on trial and they were trying to debate on what they should do with the apostles. Should we put them in prison? Should we kill them? Should we let them go? And then we pick up here in verse 34. Now remember, we were just talking about the Pharisees had this view. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered that the men be put outside for a little while. Then he addressed them, "Men of Israel, consider carefully what you intend to do to these men. Some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. He was killed, all his followers were dispersed, and it all came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed, and all his followers were scattered. Therefore, in the present case, I advise you, leave these men alone. Let them go. For if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourself fighting against God." So there you have this belief. You can see that Gamaliel was expressing the Pharisaical belief that God is providentially in control of all these things. And you're only going to be fighting against God if you try to put these men in prison and persecute them. So that's another interesting belief that the Pharisees had. Any questions or comments before we move on from the beliefs? Daniel. Yep, we'll give the opposing side here in a minute. Yes, Daniel. The question is, what was the belief in the resurrection among the Jews and the Pharisees? And I think it falls into the category of one of those things that's taught in the Old Testament, but it's not exactly clear how it's going to work itself out. Even the same as with the expectation of the Messiah. You know there's a Messiah coming, but we don't really know what he's going to look like. You know, a lot of people believe there's going to be a political ruler. I think the doctrine of the resurrection is similar. So Martha knows that there is going to be a resurrection at the last day. So the Pharisees definitely believed in that resurrection. That it's taught elsewhere in the Old Testament as well. Daniel 12:2 is another passage that refers to it, and there's a passage in Isaiah. We'll look at those in a second when we talk about the Sadducees. And it's hard to tell, too, because we have limited statements from Josephus. So it's the same case whenever you're trying to interpret history. Somebody says something, and you have that to go on, but maybe he would have said more if, like, we know that they believed in a resurrection of the virtuous to new bodies, or other bodies, I think is the term that Josephus uses, but they don't specifically say that there was a resurrection of the unrighteous, but they do say that their souls will go to eternal punishment. So it's just not clear whether they believed in a bodily resurrection of the unrighteous as well. But they definitely had a concept of the resurrection of the dead at the last day and judgment, rewards, and punishments. And I'm sure that's what Martha is referring to in that passage. Yeah, Bill. So I want to be careful with one thing you said there, that the apostles are separate because they were called out. Everybody who is going to believe is going to receive that call. So I don't think that we want to necessarily discount the fact that the apostles followed Jesus. Now, they weren't the Pharisees and the scribes. They weren't the elite people, but... Right. But remember, there were other people who had that same challenge, like the rich young ruler. Come and follow me, and he didn't follow him. So I know what you're saying, but just recognize that anybody who responded to Jesus the right way is responding to the effectual calling, if is what we call it today. Yeah, so that's a good question about were there other Pharisees or scribes who were seeking. And I think the witness of the New Testament is that we know that there were true believers, and you know we have the examples of the people who were expecting the Messiah. But even within the party of the Pharisees, we have at least two examples that I can think of off the top of my head. So Nicodemus was a Pharisee and a member of the council, and we know that he came at least at the end and was participating in Jesus' burial. We also know Joseph of Arimathea, who was the one who came and requested Jesus' body, was a member of the council. We don't know if he was a Pharisee or a Sadducee, as far as I know, but he would have been on the council, so he would have been somebody in authority. So there are definitely examples in the New Testament of people who did respond, and so we might infer that there were others as well, possibly. So we have the most obvious example, which you're probably going to discount, though, because he was a special calling, was Paul. I'm just making a joke. Yeah. Well, Nicodemus is a great example, right? Because he came to see Jesus at night. He was asking him questions, didn't understand, but then we see him at the end of the story as a true believer, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's a good question, though. It's very mysterious to us, and it probably shouldn't be, because we have the same thing with our friends and family. You know, why do some people believe and others don't? You know, it's the same question. So, it's because it's the work of the Spirit. It opens our eyes.